This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Farah Ahmad.
I'm Vizla Kumaresan.
This is Digital Desires, the show that explores how screen culture is changing human interaction. So we're going to talk about how it has never been easier to cheat on your partner due to technology. What do you make of this, Vizla? Does it surprise you?
No, it doesn't. and to explain that, you know, as we were starting the show, Fuad and I looked up apps that enable people to cheat. And apparently there are at least 25 apps that help people to cheat on their partners.
Yeah, I'm looking at this article on Complex Magazine that's pretty much matter of fact. It just says 25 apps to help you cheat on your girlfriend, so it's not gender neutral there. It just goes straight to it. There's no qualification, no apologies in advance, no pretension about it. So I guess that's where we are nowadays.
Yeah, and there's already this expectation that it will be men who will do the cheating, isn't it? So this particular article is targeted at men. And by that same vein, it's also providing ammunition for their potential partners to also pick up on those apps, look out for those apps on their phones, which brings us to the second part of what we'll be discussing. While it's never been easier, never been harder to cheat, it's also never been easier to get caught cheating.
Right, that's true. That's true. Well, the first thing that comes to mind, and this is often an issue now among couples, is that the access they should have to your devices, right?
Mm.
Now, because I think this is a new experience, right? The fact that we're so interconnected, largely through one thing, whether it's your phone or your tablet, sharing your life with a person should also mean sharing these devices. I mean, if you share a TV, why not you share details on your phone? What do you make of that logic, Vizla?
I don't think it's logical at all.
Okay.
I'm of the view that, and this is something I practice in my personal life as well, something I practice in my professional life. Privacy is important. So I really don't encourage couples especially to share passwords or, you know, for people to look into their partners' emails, mobile phones, check their messages. I don't think that's very healthy in a relationship. But a lot of people think that that's necessary and important because you are intimate, because you are a couple. And therefore, when you are a couple, you lose your identity of two separate people and you become this one entity, which is not very healthy. But that's what people expect, right?
Right, right.
You know, the whole, you know, two become one and all those kinds of things. Mm. You think you just become one object and that one thing should have access to everything that the other person is thinking about doing and all these kinds of things. I don't think that's very healthy. I think it breeds a lot of distrust. I think it, you know, it's fertile ground for a lot of suspicious behavior. It's also fertile ground for abusive behaviors to start. We don't think, you know, a lot of this is actually manifestations of controlling behavior.
Mm-hmm.
We think it's romantic, but it's not. You know, it's quite sinister. And I'm very wary of things
right.
like that.
Now, can't we have our individual personalities without it being passworded, right? Because I get it that you're right. We should be able to have these boundaries as to, you know, what we should even be curious about, right? I shouldn't be curious about my partner's emails, for example, right? But that's not the same as to say that when I feel like it and I don't know when that need might arise, I shouldn't look at it or something like that, right? So isn't the secrecy part unhealthy?
Well, I think it's how you're being secretive. Generally, my line of work, I'm quite secretive because I deal with confidential information. That's a really good reason why I don't let other people access my phone. I don't let other people access my contact list, my email.
But these are not other people, right? These are the people. This is somebody presumably you live with.
Yes,
day in and day out.
Especially these people.
Oh. Okay.
You know, when the phone rings, I get up and I answer the call in a different room. I sometimes have to lock the door when I take phone calls. And that is actually because of the nature of my work. Right? As a clinical psychologist. All my files are passworded. And there's a lot of reason for that. So in that sense, that secrecy is necessary. And I imagine a lot of people in professional, you know, jobs have that kind of confidentiality would prefer that kind of confidentiality. Yeah, and I get those when I leave the room to answer a phone call and then I come back and goes, oh, who was that? And I'm very vague about it. And that's fine with me.
Right.
But then if I'm sitting in the company of others and I'm very secretly, you know, hiding my phone, I'm replying messages, but I'm making sure people don't look at the screen. I'm, you know, smiling at the screen very coyly, and I'm not telling anybody what's going on. People ask me what, and I'm being very coy or secretive about it. That's a very different situation. So I think there are secrets, and then there are secrets.
Right, right. So there are secrets insofar as you need it in a practical sense, because that's how things work, right? In the sense that emails, it's not just the partner or whatever. The idea is that it has to be protected, right? And you don't want to compromise that protection. But it's also a secret that's maybe like as a result of paranoia or something like that, right? Which we're trying to protect something else behind it or whatever. So I think it's good. I think that that's an interesting point as to like how is it that we do want to maintain certain things that matter to you in your terms and not someone else's. Now, it seems to be to me that there is this increasing kind of temptation to infidelity. Now, there are two ways to look at it. One is that this has always been part and parcel of, I guess, quote unquote, the relationship game or whatever. But this is also something, a new demand that's created, right? And partly insofar as a lot of these things are also businesses, right? They thrive on wanting more and more people to cheat, right? So how do these two things meet, right? Help us understand like the psychology of it in that would there be this frequency of infidelity if there weren't this many apps that help do that?
Well, to be fair to the apps and to technology, infidelity has always existed, isn't it? I suppose 20 years ago, where gender norms were different, there were certain clubs, there were certain places where quote-unquote respectable women don't go. And, you know, it's assumed that if you'd want to cheat on someone, if you'd want to pick up someone, that's where you go, right? So that was how it was done then. And of course, those gender norms are changing now. A lot of these places don't have that kind of reputation anymore. Women have more access to public places. So the spaces in which these things are being negotiated are changing.
Right.
And so where it used to be more public spaces, now it's turning to more private spaces in terms of it's your handheld devices, phones, tablets, whatever it is. It's basically just changing the platform.
Yeah.
And the fact that there might be 25 apps, if not more, begs the question, are the apps serving the need or is the need being driven by the apps?
Yeah. What is that?
I think it's the other way around.
What is that need anyway? I think what's plain to see now, if you've just familiarize yourself with the dating world is that people who cheat are not necessarily unhappy, right? They're not necessarily lonely. They might be bored, maybe. I don't know. But is this a sign that we have to rethink our relationships if cheating has become so popular, right?
Yeah. So I think this is where the sex therapist, Esther Perel, this is what she talks about, correct? She says that cheating is more a sign of how people are expecting too much of their partners rather than it being a state of the relationship itself.
Okay.
So, you know, she has a book out. I forget the name right now, but perhaps we can look it up during the break and we can share the name afterwards. And she talks about how relationships, the expectations of our partners are at the highest now than it's ever been in the past. Like, we expect our partners to not only provide for us, not only, you know,
make us happy,
you know, be the perfect cook. You know, you have to be dashing, debonair, slim, buff, you know, prepare you a 3-course meal, on top of that, drive a fancy car and dress nicely.
Take you all over the world.
And on top of that, you know, have these witty, engaging conversations all the time, be funny all the time, not have any bad moods.
Oh, it's so hard to be a
partner. All those things, you know. Exactly. And people buckle under that kind of pressure. People buckle under that kind of expectation. And so she argues that when people cheat, it's because it's a sign that they face too much pressure in that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And they want a situation where they can just sort of escape that. Or it's a sign that the relationship is unhealthy because of those expectations.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what she says. I don't know. I mean,
you
know, cheating is, I suppose it's a bit of a landmine issue to discuss. It's hard to explain why people have different reasons for it, from, you know, psychological to the very moral kinds of things. It's a huge, touchy topic.
Yeah.
But more on that after a break. You listen to Digital Desires on BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat alongside Vizla Kumarisan. This is Digital Desires, where we talk about how screen culture is changing human interaction. The topic this week is infidelity. In the first part of the show, we talked about the abundance of apps now that offer safe, convenient and efficient ways to cheat on your partners. And we've been reflecting on what that might mean. So we ended the first part with a reference to Esther Perel, and we didn't get the name of the book early on, but now we have it. It is called The State of Affairs.
That's correct.
And it's an interesting book, but I think you can find the same arguments summarized in many of her TED Talks too.
Yes, yeah. And I think Esther Perel also has podcasts.
Ah, yes.
And I think if you search for her, you'll find quite a lot of resources if you really want to understand this topic further.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the biggest issues that comes out from a couple or a relationship where there has been cheating is that there is immense betrayal of trust. And this betrayal actually is quite... I don't know, for lack of a better word, fragile concept, because quite a lot of things can constitute betrayal, right? For some people, it's a very clear clear line that if you have sexual intercourse with someone else while you are with me, that is betrayal. That's it. For other people, it is when there may not have been any sexual interaction.
Could have been flirtatious or something, right?
It could be flirtatious. It could be that this person is spending a lot of time chatting with this person, this other person. It could also be that one partner has turned to this third person at a time of vulnerability or emotional crisis. So rather than speaking to their partner, they're speaking to this other person while there's no sexual interaction. Emotional sharing might be considered betrayal.
Intimacy, right? That's sort of emotional intimacy,
yeah.
Right?
So when you think of the range of behaviors that people attribute betrayal to, a lot of these things can be done using our phones,
mm-hmm.
right? We chat all the time. Each couple also has a very different requisite for what is cheating and what isn't.
Yeah.
If I play a sport and I become I pick up badminton and I pair up with this particular male player every game, and then we end up sharing jokes and we end up, you know, having a little WhatsApp group where we talk about when we're going to practice or whatever, my partner might be jealous.
Yeah. And a lot of it depends too, right? You could be emotionally intimate with person A and that's not a problem, but then person B is a problem, right? So a lot of these things depends on the perspective that's feeling the suspicion. There's also micro-cheating these days, which is also very tech-driven, right? Because it happens also online, right?
Yeah. And the other thing is also in this day and age of Tinder dating or, you know, online dating or whatever you call it, you can be with someone, you can be on a date with someone and be arranging your next date with someone else. And that's also very easy to do. Would that constitute cheating, you think?
Not unless that date is already something in an established relationship or something like that. But if it's just like, you know, well, the word date can mean many things too, yeah. Right? It could mean something from meeting each other for coffee to like a proper inauguration of a relationship. But yeah. I would say if there's already something agreed upon with another person, then you shouldn't be arranging Tinder dates.
Yeah, exactly. Right? I was going to say that. I mean, if you've agreed to, say, have a meal with me, or even if it's just coffee with me, it's going to be with me and you shouldn't be...
Yeah, I think this goes back to being fubbed. Is that the term?
Fubbed?
Like, let me check. But there's a term where fubbed is phone snub.
Right, oh, right. Okay. So P-H-U-B-B-E-D.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it doesn't have to happen in the romantic context. I mean, that's where the term fubbed emerged, right? Phone snub is a combination of those two words where, you know, even if you're with a friend or a colleague who's talking to you, you don't want to snub that person by being fixated on what's on your phone, right? So what more when you're already in a relationship? So I think one of the things that struck me out of what Esther Perel said is that the reason why we are so invested in one person to give us quote-unquote all is because we live largely in the modern world in isolated conditions, right? We're more inclined to think individualistically. Relationships in general are harder to maintain as a result. Our sense of like connection to community is much, much more tenuous nowadays. There are a lot of economic insecurities as well. So our partner is supposed to calm us on that front too. So unfortunately, the partner has to embody a lot of security that we used to get from other people, whether it's from family, whether it's from, you know, a more secure sense of our economic position and stuff like that, right? So I think then that echoes a lot of the conditions of modern living too.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
And the other element also is, I gave earlier an example of what it was like 20 years ago. If you'd go to a club, you have maybe 10, 15, 20, 30 women to choose from at any given night. You go online and you have tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of choices, right? And so there's also that element has changed. And I suppose FOMO kicks in, right? The fear of missing out. What if there's something better out there and I have made a bad decision with this one? You know, I don't want to, what's the word? Be tied down?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
What am I missing out on, right? What kind of new experiences? Oh, that's the kind of logic right behind it, perhaps. And this replicates the logic that's pretty much governing our social media use, right?
Yeah. And so if I see pictures on Instagram of couples, you know, going to fancy restaurants and going to all these beautiful places, and I can't do that with my partner, and I really want to do that, what do I do instead of, you know, negotiating those things I want? I go and find someone else.
Now, is it the case too that we're seeing a certain like expiration of the monogamy, you know, like of monogamy, right? In that monogamy too is a recent construction, right? It came out of a certain historical period where the old form of kinships could no longer hold. So as society modernizes, people think of individuals getting together rather than families getting together. I mean, all this to say that the way in which we maintain relationships are reflective of a certain context, right? Could this be the fact that people are more inclined to go on these apps suggest that the old ways of thinking about monogamy is coming to an end, that we have to rethink relationships more broadly to
I think monogamy has always been contested, right? I think it has something, definitely it's, perhaps it's a new concept, but it's only new also in terms of the fact that it's been defined only for the male perspective. It's always been assumed that only men cheat.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's almost impossible for men to be in monogamous relationships.
Right.
And there's been a whole lot of social, religious, legal sort of structures to, you know, to make sure people remain in monogamous relationships, marriages and things like that. I think that aspect is new, right? Having this legal implication,
right.
and the other things. But I think monogamy has always been a contested issue. So it's not something that's new, I think.
Mm-hmm. But does this suggest or signal a nail in the coffin of sorts, or is this just an aberration in what's already the rule, right? So do you see this as calling for a new discussion about what partnership means in the 21st century, or is it just something that's a small thing that is a subculture of its own?
Yeah, I think it's definitely an indication that we really should start talking about these things. I suppose people have always just taken for granted what relationships mean.
Mm-hmm.
How did we expect monogamy to be a part of relationship? Do we even talk about it when we begin relationships, or even when we, you know, when the relationship turns serious? People mm-hmm. don't talk about it. It's assumed that it's a given. And I think that might be a mistake.
Yeah.
Right? Because you need to start as early as possible to talk about what is acceptable and unacceptable behavior with regards to your partner and other people.
Yeah.
And that discussion has to be ongoing and constantly revisited, because what you want from a relationship when it starts is quite different from what you want in a relationship 10, 15 years down the line.
Yeah, there's a podcast that I heard once. This was a while ago, and I wish I could remember the title, but it's basically a narrative of a person who's trying open relationships.
Mm.
And it starts out as very sanguine, like he's really into it and he feels his newfound freedom. But then in time, as those connections become actual relationships, he realizes how exhausting it is. Right? So the romance phase, like a lot of different things, right? Not just in relationships, but any newfound discovery.
It's not so much the romance, but the thrill of it fades,
the
right?
The thrill of it fades too, yeah.
And
so,
and we all have that. When we have something new, it's really fun and it's really nice. And all of a sudden, one day you're bored of it.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, there's only so much time you have to work with any given moment. And there are demands too as you build these connections. So maybe there's an app that can help manage these things one day. Who knows? Manage your open relationships, right? You never know.
No, but that's not what technology is interested in doing.
In what sense?
You know, in managing the nuances.
No.
Right? It's there. It's there to get participants.
A lot of it's volume. Crude
exactly.
volume.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's there to get participants because you might have to pay for subscription. Or the more subscribers it has, the higher the revenue from advertising it's going to get, and all those kinds of things. That's what these apps want.
Yep.
Right? And again, we keep coming back to this topic. I think technology is really tapping into our insecurities,
mm-hmm.
and it's not giving us anything new,
yeah.
I think, in this sense. I mean, there's lots of new things that can come out of it, but in this sense, it's just tapping to an insecurity that's always been there.
Yeah, so the more things change, the more things stay the same, right? I like that phrase, right? In that we have illusions of like changes that merely reinforce what we've always been anyway. And that's why I think people can relate to Black Mirror, right? Because that's the theme that it plays with, right? The underside of progress, and that however much you advance, the ghosts that you couldn't shrug off to begin with will just trail with you. So any concluding thoughts, Vizsla?
Nothing cheery. I don't know, I'm just kind of struck by the frailty of human lives.
Yeah.
Oh my God, this is such a dark topic.
Well, I think one way to look at it is just, you know, since I've gotten off social media, I've been able to discern these things a lot more. Because I think prior to this, largely, you know, this show has helped a lot for me to just kind of back off, you know, from being so hooked on the screen. But once you maintain some distance from it, you can discern a lot better, right? And I have that distance that, in a way, buffers me from just being totally, like, sucked into it all, you know?
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I suppose last thoughts would be for people to get off their phones and start living their lives.
Yeah, that's our recurring message, isn't
it? Our recurring message.
Yeah, I'm not giving up on that because I think it's a good message. I feel like we should do that more and more. In any case, you can email the show at biggerpicturebfm.my. Look us up on Facebook too, Digital Desires. Always look forward to your tweets at bfm.my. Just, mention the show if you feel like chiming in. Once again, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat alongside Vizla Kumarison, and this is Digital Desires on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.